to the Monsters and Myths show, where we expose those innovation inhibitors, barriers, and blockers that you're likely to experience on your innovation and transformation journeys. Today's guest is Mark Dowd. And Mark is a CIO advisor. He's been a CIO advisor for many years. It's actually how we met. He, unlucky for him, was assigned to me many years ago. And when I was in a previous corporate life, and we struck up a friendship that went way beyond the professional, I'm glad to say, in terms of we've carried on our friendship long after our respective roles have transitioned and we've gone on to do other things. We've actually even managed to do some business together independently in various projects that we've worked on. And I've been really, really looking forward to have Mark on here because Mark has a background in psychology, believe it or not, and many of our conversations delve into the philosophical and touch on the psychological elements of change, the real human elements as well. So I'm looking forward to seeing what Mark has to say. Mark, would you like to give the viewers and listeners a bit of context as to why you've encountered so many monsters and myths so far in your life and probably will encounter many more still to come?
Thank you, Andrew. Yeah, so I've been an advisor for CIOs for about the last 16 years or so. And what that means is that I work for a research company and we do lots of research on what you should do. And what I try and do is make that personal, make that actually fit what people are doing. And I guess the real story is that I speak to CIOs by clients every month, at least every month, sometimes every week, for long, long periods, for 6 years at a time in some cases. And I work with them on their journeys. And over all this time, I think I probably worked with, I don't know, 160 CIOs. So I've seen a lot of things go wrong for other people, more than I would do if I was doing it myself, if that makes sense. And a lot of what I do is part of that warning. It's like, don't go there. There's a monster. You know, so this is a perfect show for me. So thank you very much for inviting me.
Brilliant. And that's exactly the kind of thing that we're after. And also, you've got experience across multiple different industries as well. Because one of the things that I often come across is that people think that the monsters and myths are unique to their industry. And something that this series is bringing out is that actually, they're the same damn monsters and myths that infect and invade and are pervasive across all industries. Doesn't matter what industry, doesn't matter what geography you're in. The same damn monsters and myths are there. So without any further ado, let's dive into your first one. Is it a monster or a myth? And what is it? Have you given it a name yet?
I haven't given it a name, but I recognize it when it comes along. And it's more of a myth than anything else. And I've seen this in a number of industries. And as to your point, I think sometimes industries are infected by this particular myth and they go, you know what we really need is some innovation. Innovation will do the trick. And then it becomes a sort of, okay, how are we going to do this? And it comes as a diktat right from the top of a corporation and goes, we will do innovation. And the call goes out and it can take lots of forms. And it could be, we will set up an incubator called XYZ Incubator, or we'll set up a lab and we'll have all the latest stuff in it. And another one is, you know, we'll go out and we'll ask our people what they think. And all of these are good things. Don't get me wrong. They're all valuable in their own right, as long as it's not just a myth. Because the myth bit is when it actually comes as a diktat from on top and the motivation is not necessarily actually doing something new. It's about getting the XYZ brand on an innovation or on the fact that we're new and hip and with it. And that can be in any industry. And the problem is that becomes a real millstone around someone's neck, whoever manages to take that on. And whenever I hear, yes, directors, board, whatever it is, have decided we're going to innovate, I go, oh no, and I groan inwardly, thinking, poor chap, you know, this poor lady is really going to suffer over time. And I don't think people notice it immediately. That's the other thing. You know, they also get infused with it and they'll take it on. And then the worst part about it is that the interest sort of fades. It becomes, I'm not so interested in this anymore. And they're left holding the baby, which can be a whole lot of startups. It can be the goodwill of the people inside the company who've put together all their great ideas, and then maybe it fades away, or it becomes, I don't know, an innovation challenge for 1 year, and everyone's ready for the next year, and there's nothing. And that's a very painful myth, I think, for a lot of people.
And it's sort of like one of the things that I identify under that is innovation theatre. Where it's the illusion of doing innovation, but actually the purpose is not to be more innovative. The purpose is to appear more innovative. And I've actually called this out with some organizations before when they say exactly the same thing as you've just described. You know, we want to be more innovative. We're setting up a lab. And I say to them straight away, okay, I'm going to call bullshit. I want to know, are you setting up a lab in order to be more innovative or to appear more innovative? And they like sheepishly look around and I go, no, look, I'm okay if all you want to do is appear more innovative, but because then your activities, what you're going to do and how you go about it, needs to be communicated in a completely different way so that you don't disenfranchise your employees. Because you can actually build up a huge reputation by looking innovative from the outside, you know, and that may be valid because it may be that what you're trying to do is attract the right employees so that you can eventually be more innovative. Or it may just be that you have no intention of yourself being innovative, but what you want to do is you want to stimulate innovation across your ecosystem. So there are some cases where setting up a lab and appearing to be innovative without actually ever releasing something innovative can be beneficial. But as you say, it's that demoralization of the employees that is a huge burden, where people go, yeah, you know, we participated last year and we had these great ideas and nothing ever came of them. And that is an innovation killer straight away.
And it takes a few years to overcome that and get back into the groove of things. And I ask a similar question. Well, I don't call bullshit because I'm not quite as much of a shitster as you are. But what I do is I say why. Yeah, and there are really two reasons. One is you want to make money, three reasons. One, you want to make money. Two, you want to improve your market share in some way. Or three, it's about perception and branding. And there's a third one that is more difficult because I find that is difficult to maintain. I mean, there's a lovely example I always think of, which was an insurance company that did motor insurance launched probably about 4 or 5 years ago, these public service, they launched public service lights in the sky, which would, if you were walking home, they would follow you home. And these were powered by little quadricopters that would light up the road. Sounded like a very fun idea. And they implemented it in one town in somewhere in England. And the idea was it would cut road deaths. Did it go anywhere? Well, actually it did. Interestingly, it then became the idea of having a network of drones was used at sea to actually find lost people and stuff like that. So they did make a use of, or a use came out of it, but it wasn't the one they initially thought of. And that was branding, really. So, yeah, that was a lovely idea.
And there are things of branding. I came up with one, and it wasn't the institution that I'd previously worked for, so I don't mind taking the mickey out of this one. When in financial services, in the fairly recent past, contactless everything was the big rage. You know, you were going to pay contactlessly and not just with your phone. And this particular institution showcased contactless earrings. Now, I want to know how those actually work. You know, are you supposed to put your ear down on the damn payment thing, or are you supposed to take them out to bed? And all of us in the industry recognized it was innovation theater. All that they were trying to do was open people's eyes. That's all that they were trying to do. They weren't ever actually going to release contactless payment earrings, but they wanted to show the ability for it to be embedded in anything. That was the thing that they were trying to go. And so there is a valid place and time, but you have to call it up front. I mean, in my opinion, the way to dispel that myth is right up front. You write the story of how you want this to be perceived, particularly internally, so that you're not giving people false hope of going, well, if I submit my idea, you know, it's going to make the company millions. If all that they are trying to do is you know, explain the art of the possible and that kind of a thing, you know, as I say, valid, but if you haven't communicated properly, can be soul destroying inside the company. How many places have you come across that have got the idea of an electronic suggestion box because they want to be innovative? And does anything happen with those electronic suggestions?
And that's a real problem. And that actually brings me on to the next one of my my monsters, which is exactly that. It's the electronic suggestion box. You know, basically easy to set up and really hard to do, because it eats up people's imagination and they expect it to go somewhere. If they've gone to the trouble of putting it in there, then they expect it, you know, something back from it. And many a time have I been involved with organizations who go, yes, we're going to go out and ask our people what they want, and then we'll give them an award. And actually, an award's nice, sure. But it doesn't, what they really want is for it to drive the company forward in some way. And everybody who doesn't get the award, if there's a 2,000 person company, that means 1,999 people are not that happy with the fact that their idea, which they really believe in, totally ignored. So it's a dangerous one, I think. That's a particularly dangerous one. And the way to do it, I think, you know, to do it successfully is to do it the way you suggest, which is to at least let people know what the outcome is. Now, I've seen other ways of doing it where suggestions then get filtered back into the business and the business gets the opportunity to invest in whatever it is. And when that happens, then there's a good business case for whether it worked or not. And it's something which most people can understand. You know, I think that if we, you know, if we didn't have bus stops there on the way to work, then life would be a lot easier. And the business case is, well, we can't get rid of bus stops. What are you talking about? How can we possibly do that? And then they go, oh yeah, okay, probably not. So, you know, there's sometimes that effort needs to come from actually putting some reality around it. And that's what people forget. They gather all these lovely ideas and then nothing happens. So,
and I can't believe that we actually came onto that. We haven't discussed what your monsters and myths are, but that was such a brilliant segue from the one into the other. People aren't going to believe that you hadn't given me your list beforehand with that one. But the electronic suggestion box idea, I have seen it done quite well, like you, in terms of I've seen it done badly more than I've seen it done properly, for sure, beyond a shadow of a doubt. I've experienced it in organizations that I've worked in, done incredibly badly. I've also experienced it being done very, very well, where, like you say, the key to me is to define a challenge and then not just to ask for general ideas. Don't just say, submit your ideas, but actually to define it and say, we have this problem faced by our customers, or our clients have said this is a major issue for them. Now, we're looking for suggestions that reduce cost, increase speed, whatever the case is, but that solve the problem in any creative way that you come up with actually has a concrete solution to the problem, or at least a possibility. And then they go through rounds, the suggestions go through voting, peer input, peer validation, and eventually ends up with something almost like a dragon's den, where the potential business sponsors have actually got budget on the table that they can allocate to try and doing a POC or a trial, or to validate or refute the solution. And in those cases, you do actually get a high degree of employee input behind them. And they don't need to be financially rewarded. They don't need prizes. Kudos and recognition is generally enough. And the pure satisfaction that actually they've seen an idea go from ideation all the way through concept validation, maybe even to production implementation. And all that they need is the process and the structure to be able to support that. Have you seen that done well in
I've seen it done very well, and usually it's well, in a couple of cases, it's been situations where they said, we have this amount of money to invest. We'll either invest in one big idea or in a number of little ideas to get to our goal, which is a financial goal of we want to make this much money back from these ideas. And by laying it out in very, very clear terms, people understand what's going on, why they should do that. And then it can be very easily explained about why this one won and this wonderful idea idea that you had hasn't won because it's too difficult to do. I think the other part of that, though, is that the innovation has to actually occur in to make that work, and it needs to go through stage gates. I think you're absolutely right. Involving people who make a choice, and I've come across some excellent software like Wazuku, for instance, which does exactly that. And you can use that with the public to help you with questions, and then you can have judges internally and externally judging. But ultimately, it also has to go through the financial governance, I think, to about whether or not this works. Because if the idea doesn't make money or doesn't save money or doesn't build brand or whatever it is that you need it to do, it's still just a good idea.
And you're aware of my making moonshine metaphor that I use, and that's the bit where I talk about in order to distill ideas, you have to throw cold water over them. And the cold water throwers are finance, risk and compliance, security, people like that. And often innovators like to gloss over that as not being necessary. You know, it gets in the way of the creative process. Yes, but there's divergent thinking and convergent thinking. Both are necessary to come up with an innovative solution. And the convergent thinking requires parameters put around it. It's not just all blue sky. It has to include those components. So I think that we both agree that the
So
electronic.
agree with that. I think it's a process, and getting the ideas and explaining where they are and formulating them is only really the beginning of the process. And as you said in your making moonshine, there's a lot more to it. And yes, it can be made into a process as long as people really take it seriously, which I guess is to my first myth. But it also brings perhaps us onto the third myth that I had, or maybe it's a monster, and that's about who do you involve in this stuff, in this innovation? Because sometimes it's seen as, oh, we'll do it in a lab and we'll fix it and then we'll make something wonderful and it'll be born beautiful and it'll be perfect first time. And of course, a bit like your t-shirt, it ends up a bit of a Frankenstein monster, and people go, I don't want that. And the worst case is when the client goes, I definitely don't want that. And there's so many companies that have fallen into that trap, I think. So involving other people is really a very big part of the process. And I've seen some horrible situations where people get caught up in the moment. They're making the lab and they're doing this. And because I deal with large companies, I deal with several people in a company at a time. And sometimes I can hear the brouhaha in the background going, This is rubbish. They're spending all this money. Why would we do this? You know, where are we going with this? And you know, here I am. I can't do this for my customer. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to boil the ocean or make a rocket ship. This is ridiculous. And that is so painful if the people who are involved, who are managing and running the innovation, don't see it. And by the way, you can shout it till you're blue in the face, and sometimes they don't want to hear it. I don't really know why. And you go, yeah, the customers don't want this. Look, your customer discovery department is saying that the customers don't want this. What are you listening to? And that becomes a problem. The other part about people is people who have to implement this thing. You know, if you don't have them on board, that can be pretty hellish as well. And I think, you know, IT in general is very good at innovating new ideas. Here's a new software package which will do this wonderful thing by thought transference for you. And everyone's sitting there, yeah, but I don't think about work all the time. What if I, you know, it takes my other thoughts and whatever it is, they'll have reservations. And so actually landing this stuff needs the people who are going to do it. And there's data of all sorts. And I think one of the really interesting views of innovation is data. And you know, I think that a lot of innovation is going to come from data. But the number of companies that are going, okay, we need data from all over the company, and we need it all to come together. So let's build a process, an innovative process to do this. And sometimes they go, oh yes, and we'll make the person who collects the data, the owner of the data, that'll work. And yeah, it kind of works if they want to be that, but they have a day job. They may not be interested. And so that's another place where innovation without the curators of the innovation or the people who are going to have to run this process in the future, without their involvement, oh boy, that could be painful as well.
The whole idea of who to involve, I have too many stories, and most of them can't be repeated, in terms of not involving the right people at the right time. Your own internal subject matter experts. Let me just rewind a little bit. People who think that innovation is done and can be done successfully in a department with a sign on the door in a bubble are delusional. Because innovation doesn't work that way. If you're being truly innovative and particularly transformative in a company, it's going to touch multiple parts of the company. And you need to involve many, many people. It's going to take the whole village. And the number of times I have been involved, I've been observing this great, wonderful idea developing in a bubble, only for one subject matter expert to go, you know, that thing that you're trying to do, you know, that technically we've got this limitation, which means it absolutely can't be done until something else has changed. And they just go brick on the bubble. There was one particular project where there was a proof of concept done on something that was going to be the next big thing. And the proof of concept, the trial, was rolled out to just over 1,000 people. And the feedback was great. Everybody was going, yeah, this is great. This is great. This is absolutely wonderful. And the department that was sponsoring this and had been developing this in a bubble with an agency and a whole lot of things went, right, well, we're going to launch this into production. Until the customer service department turned around and said, hang on a minute. We are geared up to handle 3,500 clients. That's our, but your proposal would expose this particular thing to 32 million people. Who's going to handle the customer service queries? And everybody went, oh. Nobody had thought of involving customer service because this was the first time that instead of producing a product that went to clients, it was going to the clients of clients. So it was a B2B company that was suddenly offering a B2B2C offering, white labeled for the clients. So it was going to end up in the hands of 32 million consumers, whereas their own company was only geared up to handling 3,500 direct clients. Nobody had thought of ever saying to customer service, what would we need to handle 32 million clients? The numbers are slightly different that you need. And this is the problem, is that a lot of people get, as you say, so caught up in this whole we're being innovative bit. And it sort of links both of your previous two, you know, in terms of the whole process, the need for innovation, what you're doing, the whole idea of how the suggestions get treated along the way, and then the who to involve, all of those are intrinsically linked underneath this whole, as you start at the beginning, why are we wanting to be more innovative? What are we trying to achieve through our innovation process? And therefore, by extension, who should be involved? And in my opinion, the answer to the last one is always the whole company. Your innovation needs to be transparent, because there are people around the place who know stuff that you don't know yet, until you go, this is what we're thinking of doing. Has anybody got an opinion on this? Because if you're not going to ask your own staff.
No, which goes back to the first problem. You know, if it is a fashion statement, if it's innovation fashion or anything like that, that is the blue-eyed boy or the toy of the board or the managing director, be careful, because if somebody comes along with a pin and fix that, but you know, you as the innovation manager is going to be left holding the baby. And I've seen this. Not directly. I've seen this to someone who was going to set up an innovation, had been asked to set up an innovation department. And he said, oh, no, not again. What do you mean, not again? And he said, no, last time I put all my best people on this. And then we came up with this wonderful idea. And somebody picked the bubble, and they were all fired. And I lost all my best people. And it's like, oh, okay, that's painful. Don't do that. But it doesn't mean don't put your best people on it. It just means be very, very careful how you present it and how you publicize it, especially internally, because I think culture eats change for lunch. It really does. And if the culture isn't going to go with it, you might as well give up. One company I worked for, they knew that the internet and Google in particular was going to literally destroy their company. And they went out and said, okay, well, we have to change the way we do business in order that our customers connect with us rather than just through a third party. And they went a long way down that route, but the culture of the company was just different. They didn't understand, and they didn't take the company culture with them. They didn't spend enough effort trying to explain that they were going to be put out of business by Google if they didn't change. And after about 2 years, they said, oh, well, this is never going to work. We'll go back to the old way. And then 2 years after that, they went, oh, Google's going to eat our lunch, isn't it? Oh, no, we better do something. Well, we should have started. Oh, we did, you know, and it's all because it was badly communicated. So bringing people on a cultural journey of innovation is huge, really important.
And that's one of the areas that we violently agree on, is that the most difficult part of innovation and change and transformation is the people. It's got nothing to do with the technology. The technology is so easy. The people.
In comparison, it is. And the people and the culture. I worked for a Japanese company in Europe at one stage, and they said, oh yeah, what we want to do is we want to innovate around the product and the messages. And I ran some workshops with these people, and from almost the very beginning, all the product managers were saying, we don't have any choice. You know, we don't get to choose anything. It all comes from Japan. You know, what we do is we figure out how we can position this in our markets. Don't tell us about new colors and or anything. You know, innovation is not really doesn't happen here. So don't make the mistake about where innovation actually happens. That's another important one. You know, who has the power to actually make these changes happen is very important.
And Mark, we have come up to time, and that was a great way, literally, to draw a line underneath it and hopefully give people lots of things to think about, particularly if they've just been given the what they thought was the enviable task of starting an innovation department.
Good luck, whoever you are, good luck. It'll be fun. Just watch out for the monsters, because there are a few of them and they'll bite you, and they bite hard.
That's it, exactly. Mark, before we close, how do people get hold of you? What's the best way if they want to carry on the discussion with you? If they want some advice from you, do they look you up on LinkedIn? Do they hunt you down on IDC? Where do they get hold of you?
Absolutely. Yeah, look me up on LinkedIn is usually the best way of doing it. It's Mark with a C, D-O-W-D. And
I'll put it in the show notes as well. I'll put your LinkedIn profile connection there in a link in the show notes. It'll go out on the podcast and on YouTube and on the website as well, so people can find you there. Mark, thank you very much for being a fantastic guest today. I look forward to us carrying on talking in the future about more monsters and myths on your journey.
Absolutely. Thanks very much, Andrew. And bye-bye.